the UCR Podcast.
Well, it's been almost a decade since my last conversation with Thomas Dolby, and it was a true pleasure speaking with the self-described recovering synth enthusiast, as his Twitter bio said at the time we last spoke. I'll link to that 2017 interview in the description notes for this episode, and you can consider that as a companion piece to today's conversational excursion. I would also suggest reading his excellent memoir, The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology, which, as the title suggests, is a captivating read that takes stock of not only his musical career, but his entire time spent working and innovating in the tech field, which really ramped up in the 90s and beyond. We're here today to talk with Thomas about his upcoming tour dates, launching in mid-April. I had the chance to see this current show last fall, and as you'll hear us discuss, he's been using some of these tour dates to workshop a secret project that he's expecting to officially begin pulling the curtain back on sometime later this year. Without giving too much away, just based on what I saw, it is something that both Thomas Dolby fans and music fans in general will really enjoy, and during today's discussion, Thomas shares a few details on what he's working on. Thomas will once again be accompanied by a full band for these upcoming shows, featuring multi-instrumentalist Andrew Lipke and bassist Gail Ann Dorsey. Ann Dorsey will also open the shows with her own solo set. ThomasDolby.com, that is the place where you can find out more information about the shows, both here and overseas, and it's a good place to add to your ever-growing list of destinations along the rock and roll information superhighway. It's Matt Wardlaw, and you can find more stories about Thomas Dolby and nearly anyone else you might be able to think of at our website at ultimateclassicrock.com. If you're just now discovering the podcast, we are closing in on 90 episodes, which means you have plenty to keep your ears busy. And if you find yourself enjoying what you're hearing, take a moment and rate and review this podcast wherever you might be listening, and follow us so you'll get future episodes as they are released. Enjoy our conversation with Thomas Dolby. You've understandably, Thomas, been pretty careful when it comes to talking about this project that you're working on. The PR for the tour says, Thomas Dolby continues to tour the world. This tour will offer a sneak preview of one of his most ambitious performance undertakings yet to start in late 2026. Stay tuned for more news on that front. So having had the chance to see the show last fall, it's incredible. So I know a small bit about what you've got up your sleeve, but what can you kind of share with folks here today about what's in the works?
Right. Which show did you see?
The Pittsburgh show.
Okay, great. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that was fun. That was a nice little converted cinema there. That was a great show.
That's a great venue. And I love the way that Gail and Andrew play into all this too. Like the whole night was just super cool.
Yeah. So, I, as you know, I've been teaching for the last 10 years or so at the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore. And, every day when I leave my office, I sort of walk past the orchestra rehearsal, and I sometimes sit in there and I listen to them. And what sort of amazes me is, you listen to an orchestra rehearsing, is that unlike machines, which you just program and they do as they're told, hopefully, without any knowledge of each other or the context in which they're playing, and that they don't really feel the vibe. With real musicians, there's this real-time thing going on between like this link between the neurons in their brain and like the tips of their fingers, on the frets, not frets, on the fretboards. And when they get locked in, it's almost like watching a school of fish or a flock of birds. You can't really determine who's making the decisions, but it just sort of moves as a mass. And I just realized that, they're responding to what they're hearing, the open strings, the resonance of their neighbors in the section, the open piano lid, the timpani, the sound from under the stage, the sound from the back of the hall. And when it gets locked in, it's just this amazing sort of organic thing. And I could sit and program my knobs and sliders for years and never approach that, that kind of organism. AI at the moment can't do that. AI enthusiasts will tell you, we'll just wait for the next rev. But at least for now, this is like a unique thing that happens when musicians play together. And I think that the real glut of content in the world over the last 20 years has come about less from musicians playing together in a room, more from the ability of mortal humans to sort of create music on a laptop, you know, and, you know, create this sort of huge volume of output. So I think this is like a rarefied thing. And it made me realize when I look back at, you know, how I started in all of this. And when I first got my hands on synthesizers, I was trying to make orchestral music with machines. Some of my contemporaries, on the other hand, sort of tended to lean into the mechanism, the coldness of machines, which was great too, you know, Kraftwerk and you know, Gary Newman and the Human League and New Order and stuff like that. And machines are cool, you know, they have a thing going for sure. But in a way I was trying to, I did a little bit of that, but more I was trying to create very symphonic soundscapes, you know, with synthesizers and samplers and so on. So at this point in my life, I sort of feel like, well, the final frontier really is the orchestra. Now, I'm not a trained musician. I can barely read music. I hear things in my head. I sort of understand how the instruments of the orchestra work. You know, I love sitting there and hearing how they work together. And I just sort of feel like I need to use that instrument, the orchestra, as the next tool to explore, you know, and a new one to add to my arsenal. I've done limited amounts of it before in film scoring and so on. But anyway, so that's sort of, you know, why I've been drawn to doing a symphonic work. But obviously, you know, doing that is hellish expensive, you know, a lot of people involved. And so what I'm experimenting with on this tour is what kind of a show can I put together? What can I write for orchestra? But I'm sort of previewing it using a combination of, you know, MIDI and samples, an orchestra projected on a screen behind me to sort of create the sense of that interaction between the band and the orchestra. And the project I'm working on is really a sort of a pastiche of my own musical journey through the 80s via the music that I made myself, via the keyboards and production that I did for other people, the performances that I did, and the stories that went along with those, which, you know, I love telling those stories. But I think that people's memory of the 80s, I'm one component of it, but people have their own smorgasbord of memories, some of which, you know, they look at with rose-colored spectacles. I mean, if you lived through the 80s, it was actually quite a dark decade, you know, what with, you know, the Cold War, paranoia, corporate greed, Thatcher and Reagan, you know, strikes, the beginning of, you know, AIDS and homelessness and those kinds of things. And of course, by today's standards, it seems quite banal, really. But, you know, if you were there, it was actually pretty dark. And so when I see these sort of rewind retro type shows that are all like, you know, pom-poms and cheerleading and, you know, girls just want to have fun and walking on sunshine, and oh yeah, that was the 80s, man. Or, you know, Bon Jovi, Pat Benatar, that was the 80s, man. It's like the 80s mean different things to different people. But I wanted to just sort of dig in a little bit to the sort of the darker side of it myself. And so that's, you know, loosely is the project that I'm working on. And you know, I don't want to get too specific about it.
Sure.
So I want to hold back on that until people are actually able to see the whole show.
I totally understand that. Like, what's interesting about everything you just said about the decade is, you're right, it was a dark decade. But and again, I think we can look at elements of this in any decade, but the tone of the music that you were talking about, and in some fashion the music that folks like yourself were working on as well, was, as it is when things like that are happening in any particular decade, the music was an escape. So you're right, like, girls just want to have fun walking on sunshine. Very deceptive now, but at the time, it's like they kind of took you away. They were kind of a welcome reprieve from perhaps everything you were seeing in the headlines. And that was before, Thomas, before we weren't even at that time dealing with the 24/7 news cycle that we're subjected to now, where it's just like something new, awful happening all the time. So it's like, that's just the 80s, where we were kind of sort of a little bit shielded from that, in the sense that the headlines dropped on your doorstep once a day instead of constantly. I guess, of course, unless you had the news on all the time, but it was different.
It was certainly different. Yeah, and you're right. It was, you know, I don't want to, you know, take away from those kinds of songs because, as you say, they were sort of, you know, aspirin for the migraines of everyday life. But then, you know, elsewhere you had people that would really, you know, burrow into it, whether it be the Smiths or the Cure or Susie or whoever, it, you know, David Sylvian,
Depeche Mode,
you know, who really embraced the dark side.
No, absolutely. For you, Thomas, doing these shows last fall in one sense, I think would give you the chance, obviously, to establish a little bit of proof of concept for yourself for the overall project. That's one potential aspect of giving fans a preview like you did. But outside of that, what was interesting and informative about the reception and perhaps feedback that you got doing these previews for you, the guy that's constantly creating and inventing? What did you learn? What was kind of your takeaway when it came to what you've had in your head about all this versus what you kind of, I think that's always, if you just break it down to like when you're somebody that writes songs and goes out and plays them live, they evolve, but you also learn interesting things about the way they're received. So if we think about it from that side of things, what did you kind of take away in that regard?
Well, I mean, as the artist in the spotlight, you know, I don't know if I'm as well equipped to actually sort of break down the feedback as you would be if you were standing at the urinals after the show. You know, it's like a collective gasp would go up when I went in, when I launched into something, you know, and I could see people nudging their neighbors and going, hey, you know, I mean, case in point, you know, over the outro of One of Our Submarines, I walk up as if I'm going to sing the, you know, the words to my own song. And instead I sing a line from The Cure's Love Song or from Mike and the Mechanics or from Duran Duran, Save a Prayer or whatever. And, you know, people's faces light up and they make connections. They understand why it's there in the context of my song, but they make connections of their own, you know, that they had from the stable of music they were listening to back then. And, you know, I think one thing is that we had our record collections back then, right? We had our favorite stuff. And you couldn't afford to just like have a limitless record collection. Most of us couldn't afford to have a limitless record collection. So you had your stash of stuff that is very precious for you. And you got home after work and you went and you flipped through and you pulled something out and you slapped it on and you listened to it. And you went back to the communion, you know, with that posse of artists that you listened to. And I think there's quite a strong crossover, you know, between me and some other artists that were my contemporaries at the time. And so I think people hearing those juxtaposed, but kind of brought to you by somebody that was actually there and sort of lived through that stuff and had connections with that stuff is feels very special in 2026, because a lot of those people are dead or in jail or retired.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve Lukather said to me at one point within the past couple of years, when they go out and they play live, you know, he's like, it's like we're a certain kind of, like we're the last of the dinosaurs. So I get what you're saying there as being one of the kind of shrinking folks that can go out there on a stage and actually speak from a perspective of you were there. So, I mean, there's also the thing that I love about this is like you've mentioned your work at Johns Hopkins. And so there's the educator part of what you do. And that's really interesting because I had a conversation last week with a hard rock musician who really loves, for example, the Iron Maiden album that a lot of hardcore fans don't. And he was telling me about other albums that he knows are similarly scorned. But what I love about it is he's younger. So he comes to this music initially, in some cases, without bias and without necessarily knowing right away that he was hearing an album that a lot of people don't like. And it seems like, Thomas, that would be a really, like it has been a really interesting element of what you do as an educator. And you spoke to this a little bit just with these shows, but your ability to kind of colorize a new generation's knowledge on various subjects. And of course, they have no shortage of ways to figure this stuff out on their own, but it seems like it's been probably really interesting and engaging for you to have the conversations that you do with your students and perhaps also younger fans at this point about music from the 80s and so on.
You know, I mean, I look at it this way. If you want to learn about the history of baseball, then you could pull up the stats very easily and analyze them from a different bunch of different angles. So you're a young baseball fan, or you could go talk to the guy that sat in his stoop in the corner that's been a baseball fan since the early part of last century. And you know that what you're going to learn from that old guy is going to be way more than you could get from all the stats that you pull down on the internet, right? Or via AI. I think the issue slightly is that because of the appetite for data that the younger generation have grown up with, right? They sort of need to be stimulated from a bunch of different angles at the same time. So they'd actually had a hard time sitting on that stoop with that old guy without getting really antsy. You know, they'd need to be looking at their phones. They'd need to be checking in on this, that, and the other. They're used to being ambushed by all of these data streams, and it'd be very hard for them to get that attention. So, okay, so you're putting a show together and you want to be an educator. You want to reminisce. You want to bring all of that knowledge and that, you know, history to the stage. You have to figure out a way to do that in a way that is going to be stimulating, is going to stimulate them on the same level that they've become used to, you know. So they're seeing videos, they're hearing quotes coming from different places, they're seeing, you know, the interaction of different elements. That's really the vision for it. And I hadn't really sort of thought about it like that until, and certainly never used the baseball analogy before. You know, I think if you ask them that question, could you learn more about the history of baseball from the internet or from talking to that old guy sitting on the stoop? They would admit rather guiltily that they probably learn more from the old guy, and yet they don't do it. They choose to, you know, to go to ChatGPT instead. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, yeah. In a way, how do you shovel all of that demand for knowledge into a format that actually meets the stimulus demands?
You've done a memoir, so you have had the chance to really microscopically look at your career, both aspects, both the musical side and the tech side of things. But as what I really liked about the show is how career spanning it is when it comes to your music. Something I said to a friend of mine was that you are one of those folks that you could do like certain folks from your decade have done, where it's like you go out and do the greatest hits thing. But it's, you're not doing that both with this show that we've been talking about and with the set list that you present. And I know that in a time before the internet was really completely widespread, there was somebody like me that came to your catalog a little bit differently, where it's like in the 80s, I heard She Blinded Me with Science. I didn't go out at that time. I was just a little bit young. I did not go out and buy the Golden Age of Wireless. So the first record that really drew me in was Astronauts and Heretics. And from there, it's like I had to hunt a little bit and go back and find Aliens Ate My Buick. And so now that I'm taking that in, that eventually leads me back to the Flat Earth, which just knocked me out. So I guess what I wonder is, you had the chance to kind of look at your career with the memoir. You're doing it in a different way with this show. How do you process the work that you've done? Like, what's kind of interesting about all these records that you've made? Like, is there, because it just seems like knowing more as I do now about the music industry, it seems like there would have been some of these records that would have been pretty interesting to get past the industry executives and so on, to have them make it to the shelf with your vision intact the way that they did. So this was all interesting music to be making when you consider the music industry part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think to be fair, I couldn't have articulated that vision to any record company executive. Even if I'd been able to, I don't know whether they would have been game for trying to implement it, trying to make it work. You know, I mean, they worked on formulas. A lot of them were quite naive. I mean, they were big music fans and enthusiasts, but they, looking back, they were quite naive business-wise, and they didn't really understand their own business. You know, they would blow half the budget on the back cover of Billboard and just hope that a couple of million people would come out of the woodwork and buy the new album because a million bought the previous one. They didn't know who these people were or whatever. They just felt, throw some money at it and it will grow. And sometimes that worked. And I don't think they really understood why it worked, you know? So even if I'd followed more conventional industry formulae, I might have got unlucky with all of that. You know, there's a hell of a lot of luck with it involved. I mean, when you have a hit, you just crack the champagne. You don't really figure out, well, what was it that worked in this case? You just go, well, let's do another one. And when things go wrong, that's when you do a post-mortem on them and you figure out, you know, why the ducks didn't line up. But I was a nightmare really for a manager or for a record company because I refused to stay in one place. You know, it's like, I can remember actually after She Blinded Me With Science, people saying, well, you are going to go back in the studio with that same co-producer and do some more like that. Right. And I was like, well, no, here is Mulu the Rainforest, you know, from my upcoming, my next project. I don't think that made them curious as to how they could back my vision and make that stuff earn them some money as well. I think they just lost, you know, they lost patience with me basically because I was so sort of mercurial. And, how do I look back at it? Didn't really bother me for a couple of reasons. Number one, it opened lots of doors. I mean, you know, having commercial success meant all these offers landed in my lap and it was like, I was a kid in a candy store. It's like, you know, let's produce this band. Let's play keyboards for those guys. Let's go on the Grammys with these guys. Let's, you know, hang from the wall in Berlin, you know, or go on stage with Bowie at Live Aid or whatever. It's like, it was great to be doing all of that stuff. And I never once thought, no, I should knuckle down and make a few more hit records, you know, for the benefit of the longevity of my career. That never bothered me. You know, so long as the repo man wasn't actually taking away my vintage Jag, then I was perfectly happy. I think the other aspect to it also is that I thrive on being floundering a little bit and being out of my depth. You know, I mean, I like being in a situation where I'm challenged, whether it be the people I'm working with or where I'm living or the new technology that I'm, you know, committing to. I find it stimulating to be, feel like a newbie doing what I'm doing and not reach for the user manual, but just like fiddle around until something inspires me. So that's all good. And then, you know, the artists that I loved when I was younger, I had no idea where they were in the charts, how many albums they were selling, how much radio play they were getting. In fact, if they'd been truly mainstream mass market, I would have felt they'd lost their preciousness for me a little bit. You know, it's like, I knew who Dan Hicks was or who Captain Beefheart was, and not all my friends did. And that was kind of cool, you know? So in a way I set out to be one of that type of artist.
How did the stuff like Dan Hicks and Captain Beefheart, how did having kind of like that non-traditional stuff in your musical DNA, how did that kind of, you know, inform what you were doing at all? Because that is interesting. Like, I mean, you just said a lot, but that's kind of just there is that. There's always the fact that at the core, I think a lot of the folks that I talk to, like yourself, somewhere in all of it, unless they're just cold in stone, they're all music fans at the end of the day. So I think that does bring an interesting piece to whatever they end up being artistically. So how did some of that, like, you know, what might have been considered by your contemporaries or friends to be the weirder side of what you were into, how did that feed into what you were doing? You know, what do you see in that regard with hindsight?
Well, it's really that anything was possible. You know, I mean, I'm somewhat rootless musically. You know, I have these strange influences, not highly trained, you know, didn't grow up in the same project as a bunch of other guys that all listened to the same music and went to the same gigs. And therefore though I didn't have a tribe, you know, musically. And then I think, you know, my real musical skill is as a listener, as a producer, as a songwriter. I'm certainly not a virtuoso keyboard player or anything. Like, I don't jam at all, you know? So given, you know, the tools that I use that enabled me to have a go at anything, if there was a genre of music or a direction that took my fancy, I'd just dive in and explore it, you know, and have fun doing it. And I always liked that, you know, there are musical idioms that I could use, I could make use of, but still hopefully retain my, my voice, my personality, you know, within those different musical idioms.
when it comes to Astronauts and Heretics, I don't recall this, but how that you had some interesting folks on that record. One of the guys that gets talked about a lot, of course, is Eddie Van Halen, but Jerry Garcia, Bob Weir, how did they get in the mix for what they did on your record? Because there were a lot of cool folks that came in to the process, and those were two of them.
Yeah. Bizarrely, I was a bit of a Dead fan, a Deadhead, when I was 15. I saw them at Alexandra Palace and various other UK gigs, which was a rare thing for the Grateful Dead in those days. I was living in San Francisco, and I just moved there, and I was invited to a fundraising lunch with celebrity waiters, and my waiter was Phil Lesh.
Awesome.
And my wife and I sat there, and Phil Lesh in an apron brought us our food. And he was busy, you know, as waiters are. I didn't get much of a chance to talk to him, but I did get a phone number, and I then had this idea to see if by any chance Jerry and or Bob would do something on my album. And I, you know, I had this song, Beauty of a Dream, and in my mind, I could hear them playing it. And amazingly, you know, they agreed to do it, but they were between tours, and they invited me to a warehouse in Marin County where they stored their PA. And there was like a little space in the middle of all of the PA stacks where they would jam sometimes. They had a recorder there. So I show up there, and you know, I was the first person there. I was kind of naively expecting, you know, Garcia to show up like on a Harley with like his colors and everything, you know, and he showed big BMW shows up, and he's in an Armani suit, you know, and chatting to him, waiting for Bob Weir. And he said, well, you know, I'd love to do this. I mean, you sell more records than we do these days. And I said, yeah, you're the biggest touring band in the world. And he sort of shrugged his shoulders and said, I don't know, man, these dirty hippie chicks just keep following us around from place to place. You know? Bob Weir showed up, and Bob Weir was very together musically. Jerry was a bit of hit and miss. I mean, it was towards the end of his life. He was a bit hit and miss at that point. And he gave me a few licks, which I was able to just about splice together into something coherent that sounded like Jerry, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't very musical. Bob Weir, on the other hand, was really on it. And interestingly, when they started to play, they were trying to sound like Thomas Dolby, you know, so they're doing sort of bleepy things and so on. And it's like, no, in my mind, you are Bob and Jerry sounding like you guys, and it fits into my record. And it took a while to get to that point where they would sort of see that. So yeah, I mean, that was a pretty wild experience, and you know, I feel very honored to have been in their presence, even so briefly.
It kind of fits the mold of what you do, because even Jerry, in sort of a more compromised state, one thing about Jerry and Bob and, you know, the other folks in the Dead that we know now is that, very much like yourself, the Grateful Dead, they were continually musically curious. So it's not hard to understand why they would be intrigued at the opportunity to come in and play on your record. And in this case, you wanted them to sound like them, but the opportunity for them to come in and play in a different sandbox and let's go in and see if we can fit in with a guy like Thomas Dolby. Like, you can see how that would have been pretty fascinating and intriguing for them.
I can. And oddly enough, you know, they said they didn't get that many requests. I can sort of see why that would happen as well. So it was definitely an interesting sort of meeting of the minds.
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't get that many requests because I think the Dead, kind of like yourself and some of your peers, were kind of pigeonholed as they did this certain thing, or the Dead, they can't play their instruments, blah, blah, blah. And I know that that's something that you and others of the 80s kind of ran up against, is that like all these people that are making electronic music, well, they're not really playing that. They can't really create things, you know. So I think that certainly for you, it had to be, when you got, like, say, the Grammy nominations that you got, for example, that had to be a certain amount of validation, at least to the industry. Like, that was a nice recognition to get, considering some of that you ran up against yourself with your own music.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, so the Grammy voting community is, I just think, Hollywood Hills, you know, I just think session players of various different generations, they appreciate musicianship, they appreciate production, and And you know, they liked what I was doing, but I mean, I think they would also recognize, you know, Steve Lukather wasn't about to invite me to come and jam with Toto. That wasn't what I do. It was more a sound. They're the kinds that keep their ears to the ground. What's in the charts now? What's on the radio? You know, who's making that stuff, you know? And they were curious about that. So, you know, there's definitely a period where I got a lot of, you know, interesting invitations, but the ones that went to the top, the front of the line were, you know, my musical heroes when I was growing up, whether it was Roger Waters, David Bowie, Joni Mitchell, George Clinton, people like that. And so it was just so thrilling to see if I could bring anything to the table with those guys.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I was going to ask, kind of on the heels of the Dead and all that kind of stuff. What's the collaboration that kind of got away? Is there one that was kind of on the table that didn't happen?
Not really that I can think of. I mean, I think it's sort of ironic that I've never actually met Brian Eno. He grew up in a small town in Suffolk where I now live, and he lives in the small town in Oxfordshire where I grew up. We were both sort of maverick synth players with not very much hair who it was more about twiddling the knobs than it was about sort of playing at a million miles an hour. And we both had a foot in both camps, sort of commercial and the art world, you know. So it's like, to me, he is the sort of Leonardo da Vinci of the music world. He invented the helicopter and the drum machine and painted the Mona Lisa, you know.
It's interesting also because your records, I had mentioned earlier, Aliens Ate My Buick, and that was a really interesting record to get on the heels of, you know, hearing Astronauts and Heretics. I think what it made me think of as I was getting ready to talk to you, Thomas, was you always had a lot for fans to discover and wonder about and figure out with your records, which I think is kind of the point. But in the case of Aliens Ate My Buick, it's like you're sitting there looking at the liner notes like you did with any artist, and you're going, who are the Lost Toy People and this and that. So there's the album cover. Of course, the album cover, all right, let's start there. Is there a good story to the album cover? Because that's a cool album cover.
You know, I just moved to Los Angeles, and it's kind of, you know, I came from a very academic, very English background. You know, my father was an Oxford and Cambridge professor. My mother taught algebra and statistics. Most of my siblings are in academia in one form or another. I went to a boys' boarding school. I wouldn't call it a repressed sort of, you know, upbringing, because they were very progressive, but it was very liberating to move to Los Angeles with all the craziness, with all the showbiz, you know, all the drugs and partying and the glitz, everything that was going on. And I felt like I was on vacation initially. I mean, I only actually intended to go for a year. And then in the middle of it, I met Kathleen and ended up sort of staying and, you know, becoming a resident in the US and stuff like that. But, you know, I was a sort of crazy bachelor living up in the Hollywood Hills by the Hollywood sign, driving a vintage convertible Mustang, going to pitch meetings for movies that never got made, meeting a lot of other interesting musicians and artists and actors. It was really like a vacation. And I think Aliens Ate My Buick was like a postcard home from there. And it, you know, it held a mirror up to my English existence in some ways, you know, to be going there and to sort of tear up the script and live a different kind of life. And so I think Aliens Ate My Buick, I mean, came about, you know, I formed that band by putting an ad in the Recycler, which is like a, you know, place where you sold your old lawnmower, you know. And I auditioned hundreds of people, and they were mostly more or less unknown musicians. One guy was the house drummer at Knott's Berry Farm. Larry, the guitarist, is like main claim to fame was that he once supported the Pope. And the Pope was over here doing the Popemobile tour. I can't remember which Pope that was, but anyway, Larry was the support act. the bass player, the only thing on his CV was that he'd done a Jerry Lewis telethon in St. Louis.
Oh, wow.
And so that was my band. And we got in a rehearsal room. I wrote the songs. We went out and gigged them, played clubs, you know, had a great time before we ever went in the studio. And when we finally went in the studio, the producer that I picked, Bill Bottrell, was a guy who, I mean, he told me he was pissed off at the sound of 80s music, that it was like all about SSL boards and 120 faders and digital reverbs and these big snare drums, and he didn't like the way this music sounded. And what he really wanted to strip it right down. He said, you know what? You take a snare drum and you hit it right with the right mic and it just sounds fantastic. You don't need all of that gunk on it. And Bill Bottrell actually, I think, single-handedly sort of put an end to that 80s sound with the Tuesday Night Music Club album,
mm-hmm.
which was really the most stripped down, bare bones. It's like, no, a Fender Twin with a good player sounds just great if you play it, if the arrangement is right and you don't do anything to it, you just make it sound. So yeah, so that was a great combination right there. So he, you know, we took my band that had played live on this stuff, put us in the studio, recorded stuff straight to two track, and then systematically replaced certain bits that needed replacing. But that was pretty much the sound of that album. But just a very different environment from any that I've made an album in before or since. And people love it or hate it. You know, some people, they say, oh man, Dolby, Aliens Ate My Buick. And other people go, oh, I love his stuff. Except that weird Aliens Ate My Buick album. Don't like that, you know. So it's like Marmite.
How do you feel about it? Because it seems like that would have been an interesting way to work. It was a very intriguing, like, I feel like now that the time that I've spent with your catalog, you know, you mentioned at some point here in the past few minutes, tearing up the script. In certain ways, with each record you did, you were tearing up the script in a certain way. Like, you were always kind of exploring. But certainly that was the record that, like, it really stuck out just how far you were pushing the boat away from the dock. It was a very intriguing record to hear at the time.
I was always jealous of the fact that, you know, writers, novelists got, to, when they sat down to work on a new idea, they could set it any period in history. They could create characters. They could do it. They could get in the head of the main character, or they could be omniscient and you know, be the eye of God, you know, and that write that their fans, their readership would respect the fact that each new novel was like a departure, like a new chapter. You know, in the music industry, once you've created the brand and established that fan base, the industry really wanted you to, you know, basically replicate it, but just change a notch or two here and there, just take it forward and keep doing that every couple of years maximum. And I don't like feeling funneled into that way of working.
How did working with Mutt Lang kind of inform just your artistic thoughts? Like, what did that kind of add to your whole thing? Because as you've kind of mentioned, like, you've had these interesting crossovers with all these folks over the years. And I'm thinking of something else just generally, but just to start there, what did you kind of take from working with Mutt, a guy that's very obsessive and deliberate about every inch of what's going on the tape and how it sounds and what people are going to hear?
I think for years, rock and roll, you didn't know what it was, but you knew it when you heard it. And it was like, yeah, you know, with Mutt, he would analyze it with a microscope, you know, down at a microscopic level of DNA, the DNA of rock and roll. And he would figure out a way to replicate it and to produce that, you know, a sound that he did on the most granular level. And it was incredibly frustrating, I think, for some people that worked with him, you know, that were used to, I mean, Brian Adams, for example, I believe had never taken more than about 6 weeks to make an album. And it takes Mutt that long to get a kick drum sound, you know. So it was amazing to watch that and to see that in action, you know, that kind of fastidious approach to, you know, to stitching things together. I mean, when I worked with him on Def Leppard, he had me replicate each string of the guitar, each of the six strings of the guitar with a single monophonic synth line. And I had to match each string so exactly that you couldn't really hear the difference between the synth and the string. And do that times six for every chord, at which point you go, well, if you took it away, would anybody notice? You know, it's like, nah, it's got to be there, man. You know, it's like, he just has the most extraordinary ears. So it's not something that I aspired to. You know, I'd rather let the magic happen and just sort of sit back and, you know, enjoy it. I think, you know, when I'm in the studio with musicians, you get these moments, these sort of magic moments that you couldn't replicate taking the building block approach that Mutt takes. And I think also, you know, as a programmer, as a synthesist, you have this sort of jealousy of somebody that could just go in a room and do it, you know, because we spend hours and days and months twiddling knobs and all of these sounds, just, they have no sense of any context. You know, they don't relate to each other. Whereas you hire a bunch of musicians and, you know, the first hour they're hugging each other and telling stories about the road, and then they get hungry and so the food comes in, and then they're tuning up and they might, you know, and then there'll just be this magic hour maybe before it starts to deteriorate, and you hope that the VUs are going and the tape is rolling, because that's when the magic's going to happen. And if it does happen, you sit back and listen to it and you don't analyze the tuning or the timing of individual notes. It's just music. You know, and that's something that you feel guilty about not having that ability if you're a programmer. There's a certain jealousy that goes along with that, and vice versa. I'm sure you know, Bob and Jerry were probably jealous of the fact that I can sit for days and months in the studio twiddling knobs and sort of sculpt a sound.
I think the common ground between you and somebody like a Mutt is that what I was thinking of was, I was thinking about this tour and again, seeing the show last year in Pittsburgh, and in the run up to that Pittsburgh show, kind of watching set lists. And I know that I had a friend that was just hoping that Urges was going to be in the set list. And I think ultimately it was, but I think it popped in and out of a couple shows, whatever the case was. But what that illustrates is, obviously at this point, everybody kind of has their favorite or several favorite Thomas Dolby songs, some of them more obscure. And what was happening in all those instances, just like Mutt, is as you're working on these songs, you're searching for a sound. You're searching for that thing that you've got in your head. How you get there might be different than how Mutt is getting there and how the Grateful Dead got there and so on. But what is kind of the song that kind of sticks with you from your career where it's like you really had to work to get it right for what we're hearing on the record at this point? What was the one that was really kind of the struggle moment?
I mean, it's an interesting question, because in a way, my favorite, you know, my proudest moments have been ones that weren't a struggle. You know, I couldn't necessarily tell you how I got there, but you know, they're just sort of there. Screen Kiss, for example, was not a struggle to make. It just sort of flowed. It wasn't the easiest vocal to sing because I'd never sung like that before. But I certainly didn't struggle with it. It just sort of came, every element of it. Conversely, the ones that you have to work hardest at to make them really good, there's a different level of sense of achievement that you get from that if you finally cracked it. And sometimes things are just elusive. I mean, I have a song called Neon Sisters, which is probably the darkest song I've ever written. And I think that was a bit of a struggle, you know, mix-wise and getting all of the parts right and sort of doing justice to the, you know, I had a very strong vision for the song initially, and it took a lot of digging and excavating and archaeology to sort of get it the way I wanted. And there's probably people for whom, you know, that was a favorite song. I think of, you know, I Love You Goodbye or Budapest by Blimp, that, you know, have a lot of epic sort of storytelling, a lot of verses with different textures that come in that create this sort of, you know, cinematic that is like almost like a scene change from one verse to the next and things like that. But yeah, I mean, I've never really struggled with stuff. I think that, you know, if I was forced by contract or whatever to make an album when I wasn't really feeling it, I think that would be a struggle. You know, I think my heart has to be in it and it has to flow somewhat in order to be enjoyable to me. But I mean, I'm just very fortunate. I'm not beholden to anybody and, you know, I'm comfortable and I've got nobody breathing down my neck, you know, telling me, you know, how to go about it. So I'm you know, very free from that point of view.
To that end, you mentioned not having anybody breathing down your neck. And certainly right now you have a big project that's occupying a lot of mental space and time spent and all that kind of stuff. But if we look back at the touring work that you've done here in the past year with Galen Dorsey and Andrew Lipke, it's not hard to imagine that some music could be made. So I wonder, if we put that big project to the side, do you have another album anywhere in your sights that you want to make at some point? Like, have you still been writing in that regard?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure if an album is really it anymore. I don't really know what an album is at this point. You know, it was a construct for in a certain era, it was a construct of like a batch of music that fit on two sides of a vinyl, you know, a record. It was a construct of, well, we're going to go out and promote the new album. So the set's going to consist of those 10, 12 songs plus, you know, six of our hits from the past or whatever. It was a construct in terms of, you know, a sort of fiscal sheet. But all of that is really blown open now, you know, with the way the industry is. So I certainly don't feel that, okay, I've got like a coherent vision for a batch of 10 or 12 songs that I'm going to go into the studio for a few months and write and record and then put it out there and promote it. You know, there are other units of music now. There's a one-off single, there are EPs, there are, you know, trickling stuff out over a period of time. There's different ways to do things. And then very often, you know, the trigger for commercial success these days, it might be a collaboration with a different artist. It might be getting a song in Stranger Things, you know. There's different things that will trigger, you know, an uptick in interest in what you're doing. And I am an exhibitionist, you know. It's like if a tree falls over in the forest, nobody hears it, you know, .. I don't like the idea of doing stuff that really makes no impact at all commercially, you know, that just sort of falls through the cracks. You know, I want there to be a sucking sound when I do something. But I mean, you know, with this project right now, I think that exists to an extent because I think that, I think there's a, that there's a movement. You know, I go to the symphony here a lot. I go to the symphony when I'm in London or, you know, other cities, New York, whatever. And I just think, you know, every major American city has got this beautiful hall. They've got this beautiful trained orchestra, been playing all their lives, you know, with all of this history. They've got a built-in audience who want to go to the symphony. And it's just it's an anachronism, really, because that music, that audience is fizzling out, you know, and COVID didn't help. And yet this platform exists, you know, with these orchestras and these symphony halls. And I want to fill it with something that is more contemporary, more timely, that would get a younger audience to go there instead of just to the club or the stadium or where they, other places they see, you know, you have this rich heritage, this legacy, you know, in the symphonies around the country. But although they recognize that they need to fill seats with a younger audience, if you sit a millennial in a seat and say, right, switch off your phone, shut up and watch the stage for 2 hours, give us $70 and don't clap between movements and then go home. You know, that's not a very good night out for a millennial, right? That's just not going to do it for them. So, but I think it can happen. So when MTV started out, a lot of MTV videos were like three cameras on a band on stage. Lead guitar solo, you shoot up his leg, you know, close up on the strings, you know. And then once the MTV platform existed, once it was out there, you know, a Peter Gabriel, a Laurie Anderson, a Talking Heads would come along and go, no, I say to the record company, you're not just going to blow $20,000 of my budget on some piece of crap. I want to be in on that production meeting because I've got ideas about how my song is represented. Let me see that storyboard. Actually, how about if we did this, you know? And so the artist started using the platform as a and making it valid. The platform existed, but it took artists to come in and fill it with valid content that had resonance, you know, at that moment in time. And I can see the same thing happening with symphonies around the country. So that's something that I'd like to be a part of.
Was the MTV thing interesting for you as far as how it might have informed things musically? Because I could see that you would perhaps start to be working on songs and just kind of naturally have in the back of your head that, like, there's going to be a video for this. And it seems like that could probably contribute to things in interesting ways creatively. Some people just hated it.
Yes, they did. But, you know, when I sat down to write a song, if I thought there's going to be a video for this, then it would affect the way that I wrote the song for sure. I mean, you know, most prominently, you know, I drew up the storyboard for She Blinded Me With Science before I had anything other than a title. You know, I didn't have melody, chords, groove, anything. My record company said, where's the song? I go, I'll bring it in, you know, next week. And I went home and wrote it. But no, I mean, it definitely informed, you know, what I was doing then. And in fact, you know, when that ceased to be the case towards the end of the 80s, when MTV wasn't as potent anymore and they were getting into reality TV and all sorts of other stuff, it took something away for me, you know, that now I had to subtract that visual element again. Yeah, that was a shame. In fact, that, you know, around about the same time, video games, interactivity, CD-ROMs and things like that were coming in. So in a way that took over in my imagination. It's like, wow, what if this was like an interactive environment? What if this was a game, etc.?
Yeah, you went down some really interesting paths. Like you mentioned some of the scoring a while back, and just like, it seems like when stuff comes along, like you doing like the Gate to the Mind's Eye and stuff like that, you kind of continually, it seems, had interesting stuff feeding your head artistically.
Yeah, and I need that, you know. I mean, whether it's a collaboration or whether it's a new toy, you know, to play around with, I definitely need to feed my head like that, yeah.
You know, to go back to the prospects of a new album for a second, what kind of got me going in that direction was just thinking about the show that I saw. And I think if you see the right show, it's going to leave you with some homework, in a sense, sometimes. And for me, I walked out of there going, you know what? It's been a minute since I've listened to the A Map of the Floating City album. I want to go back and listen to that record again. And it was interesting to me how well you could take a song from that record, for example, and how well it fit in with the rest of your body of work. There's a consistency, I think, in some form to the albums that you made. And I know that the way you approach putting together the songs for this show, it's very apparently carefully considered. But as you know, also, not everybody has that kind of catalog consistency to where they can take really kind of their entire body of work and draw on all of it without having certain things stick out. It's like, oh yeah, that was that weird album, you know? So it was kind of cool to see all that play out in that way.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I'm glad you see there's consistency. You know, I worry sometimes that I'm just too hard to pigeonhole because I'm always off on some new tangent and you can't please everybody, you know, all of the time. But yeah, I mean, I think there is a narrative through line, but I think that you have to be somewhat open to that and not say, oh, you know, I hate guitar and drum music, or I hate electronic music, or I can't believe he did that Americana thing. I hate country music. You know, you can't approach it like that. You have to be open to the idea that I'm enjoying myself playing around with these different musical idioms.
Last few things from this side. You mentioned the Human League's I'm Only Human. And that's one thing I've kind of enjoyed is on Twitter recently here in the past month, you've kind of just been putting out like a little, almost like a little digital poll to, you know, fans going, you know, what do you think of this song? You know, I'm Only Human, kind of a polarizing song, depending on who you're talking to. It made me wonder, as somebody who was and continues to be so technologically engaged as you are, like how often were things perking up your ears through the 80s that fired up your curiosity on an ongoing basis? Because it's not hard to imagine, you there in your electronic laboratory trying to figure out how they made certain sounds for sport at the very least. So how much was that actually going on as you're hearing music? And granted, you were, one thing I hear from people is I was really busy with my own career, so I didn't hear a lot of it, but you seem like somebody that you probably did hear a lot of it as you were going along.
Yeah, I mean, I heard a lot in the 80s, you know. I mean, I sort of, in a way, stopped listening to music very much after that. In the 90s, I was all wrapped up in my, you know, software company and things like that. Occasionally, you know, something would pop up, you know, Radiohead or Bjork or something like that. And I go, oh, okay, what's going on here? You know, but there was like far, that happened far less often, you know, in the 90s and beyond. And these days. And but I'm curious when people whose tastes I respect and who seek out music, new music to enjoy more avidly than I do, when they rave about something, I'm always curious to hear it. I never spent any time trying to figure out how somebody did something. You know, I was able to be enough of a just a fan, you know, with the music that I did listen to just enjoy it without needing to analyze it per se.
The other one that you mentioned is, you mentioned like White Wedding and Rebel Yell, and, you know, having talked to Steve Stevens, I know that he was really driven by both he and Billy, I think, and a guy like Keith Forsey, they were all really driven by hearing what others were doing in some ways. And the 80s just generally seemed like a decade in music that things were competitive, perhaps more, or at least in different ways, compared to previous decades, due in part to the rapidly advancing technology. How much did you kind of see that, well, at least with hindsight, that perhaps that decade was a little bit more competitive in that way? Because I think that creative types tend to thrive on that competitive nature to a point, and the 80s seemed like it had a lot of that going on.
Certainly in the UK at the beginning of the 80s, it felt very frosty, hostile, competitive. And I think looking back, you know, what had happened was that we had this generation of you know, world-beating pop stars from the 60s and 70s, you know, from the Beatles and the Stones through to, you know, Led Zepp and Pink Floyd and so on. And but they had now been knighted. They were living in, you know, stately homes in the country, or they'd left the country altogether or whatever. And this young generation came up, and it was almost like a jostle to see who was going to inherit, you know, the spotlight from the previous generation. And so, and what was that going to look like, you know? So it's like, I certainly in the beginning of the 80s, I remember, you know, you would do Top of the Pops, that basically was the key to everything at that point, you know. Same producers as Radio One. So basically there's a handful of BBC producers who could make or break your record, you know, on a whim. Top of the Pops was shot in this big round building called White City, which the BBC had. And when you went there, you had to walk around this circular corridor looking at the names of the stars on the doors. You know, be going, okay, Turan Turan, you know, Adamant, you know, Thomas Dole. Okay, this is me, you know. But if you came out of your dressing room at the same time as Adamant, you would both sort of like turn your noses up and walk in the other direction and probably meet again like 360 degrees the other side of the building. But there was definitely, quite a strong rivalry in those days. And this was all fueled in a way by the snootiness of the music press. You know, New Musical Express, for example, was the absolute Bible of sort of musical taste. And a typical NME writer would slag off 95% of everything. And then with the remaining 5%, they would sing, you know, the praises of some unknown band from Manchester or something like that, and say, this is the future of rock and roll. But there was just this, they were very, very quick to jump on, you know, slagging you off if there's anything remotely they didn't like about you. And one of the, they had a lot to hate about me. I'm middle class and clever and white, and only music journalists were supposed to be, you know, that. And then I refused to be pigeonholed, you know, I and then, you know, just cap it all, I was successful in America. So it's like, ah, well, enough said. So it, you know, that's one reason I had to get out of there. You know, I just didn't like that environment there. And conversely, I came to the States, everybody was, hey, love your stuff, man. What can I do to help? You know, when I, why don't you come down to the studio and meet my friends, or, you know, can I come and see you live, you know, get on the guest list. It was like, everybody was up for it all the time. And that was very liberating.
Here's, I think, the final thing. And that is, we see a lot now of bands and artists, going back and remixing a particular album, not always because they hated the original mix, but sometimes they're just curious, as I think you've been, again, like just with today's technology, what would I have the opportunity to do now that I can go in and mix this record with today's technology, with an eye to not sacrifice what we did back then? How much interest do you have in doing something like that with any of your music?
Zero. I think I basically made two mistakes in production ever, and that was just by turning a knob slightly too far and then feeling that time was fleeing and didn't have time to go back and fix it, you know. But there's very little that I regret. You know, I sometimes think about the sequencing. I sometimes think that, you know, Hyperactive really belonged on Aliens Ate My Buick, and Budapest by Blimp really belonged on The Flat Earth. You know, those are both sort of slightly out of place. But I mean, no, I mean, I'm not going to change running orders on albums or anything like that. I would, you know, there is a side of me that thinks I'd love to, you know, I did this KCRW guest DJ thing where I did, you know, 5 days of that. And I did, one of the sets I called Side Two. And that basically consisted of my songs that I'm sort of most proud of that most people don't know about. And they're definitely a softer side, you know, things like Beauty of a Dream, Screen Kiss, The Valley of the Mind's Eye, just some of the sort of more unusual things. Sometimes I think, well, I'd love it if a record company came along and said, you know what, we love that stuff too. And we'd like to push that out there. And we think the fact that people missed it the first time means that it's actually got a shot right now of happening in a big way now, you know, and having a sort of revival like that, like, you know, Leonard Cohen spent 2 decades sort of gathering dust on at the back of people's records collections, and suddenly he was back, you know, with a vengeance, or Johnny Cash or whatever, you know, that, you know, in your later years when you've just got one foot in the grave, people think, well, we should maybe give him his dues while he's still around, you know?
At the very least, I think that you mentioned Radiohead. I imagine that Radiohead would probably smile knowing that somewhere out there, Thomas Dolby heard what they were doing. And he was like, oh yeah, I like this.
Well, get this. So I went to the same school as them. It's up in Wikipedia, but Tom York once in an interview said, yeah, it was great. I mean, I'd go to the practice block and stumble into a room and there's Thomas Dolby playing with a synthesizer. And it's like, okay, but I actually left there 12 years before you guys went there. So I was kind of pissed at him for that, but I jokingly said to his manager once, you know, so I think he owes me at least a co-write on a future Tom York solo album for that, getting away with that little ruse.
Well, fantastic, man. We'll cap it there. I think folks are really going to enjoy this tour, and you know, thank you, man. We're all, of course, looking forward to seeing what the big thing is later this year, and I know you'll be happy to eventually unveil it in its proper way.
All right, well, thanks, Matt. And let me say, I really appreciate you did your homework, and thanks for being so well-informed and asking really interesting questions.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.